Evening all, thank you for coming out on this soft Irish evening. And I'm delighted to see that the other board members are here, including George Doherty, Sean Kelly, Judith McGuire, maybe missing some others, and distinguished faculty. I had the pleasure of learning from them, Professor Mick Maloney, Professor Marion Casey, Miriam Nine, maybe some others here. Anyway, it was a fabulous, I'll give a little plug for a second. EMA is a fabulous thing to do. Yeah. It's rejuvenating, it's inspiring. The teachers are tough and robust, and but you learn so much. So I'm very, very happy that I did that. So we have a great evening in store for you with the magnificent Ambassador Geraldine Byrne-Nason. I'll start out by asking a few questions, but I want you to have your questions ready so we can have a traditional, lively Irish evening. Now, as you heard from Kevin, the Ambassador has chalked up enough achievements for at least five people in her lifetime. And I won't recount those again, but Brett Bruin, in a recent description of an outstanding career U.S. Foreign Service officer, could have been speaking of the Ambassador when he wrote, "She's your ideal example of a diplomat, cool under pressure, confident, super smart, and deeply committed to the mission." So that's our Ambassador. When I became an Irish diplomat in 72, there was still a marriage ban on married women joining, staying on the public service. In fact, sitting across from me in my first job was a distinguished civil servant called Tony Nolan. And she was in her 50s, but she hadn't married because she wanted to hold on to her job and her economic independence. That ban, thankfully, ended a year later, and we've made significant progress since then, as you can see from tonight, but still a way to go. So, my first question, Ambassador, is how did a young woman with a BA and an MA in literature reach the top of the Irish Public Service and become chair of the UN Global Commission on Women?
Starting with honours, maths, questions first. One important element of my biography, which you omitted to mention, very clever, is that I'm from Drogheda, and that probably explains it. I can leave it at that. For those of you who are not Irish natives, you won't know that the county I come from, County Louth, borders on the county Ted comes from, and there's a fair degree of competition between us. But that doesn't explain it all. Look, I have to admit at the top that this wasn't part of a grand design or a plan. Am I too close to the microphone for conversation?
Yeah. No, it's okay.
As you said, I studied literature, so I didn't enter as a freshman knowing what a fresh woman, what I wanted to do in my career. I really saw myself staying in an academic zone. So it was a chance encounter that moved me to diplomacy. I won a scholarship and was told I couldn't have the money unless I signed up for some career advice, and I obviously duly did that. I have to say, when I joined, I joined the Foreign Service in 1978, and most women in the Foreign Service at that point were junior officers, so there were very few of us who had really scaled the heights. At that point, there had only been like one female ambassador in the system.
Right.
So we were, all of us really, in many ways, learning by doing. The Irish system still doesn't, and didn't then, have a formal training system. So we literally were on the job from day one, and I think that was a huge advantage. Remains, though, for young Irish women in particular, that we weren't put into a competitive zone and an academic training session before we were let out. That we were, I think, allowed very quickly to use what I regard as very strong female skills, the soft power skills, the capacity to listen. I think being a female diplomat, frankly, on occasion is easier than being a male diplomat. I don't feel women are as driven to engage publicly and speak their minds straight away. So listening and learning was a huge part of our early training. And I, very early on, also took a sort of a liking for the multilateral diplomacy, what we call multilateral. So an opportunity to be trading your country's interests around a big table with a lot of other diplomats, which allows you to work on substance, but also hones your skills culturally across a lot of countries. So I spent time initially here in New York, and then subsequently in disarmament, went on to work in Brussels. So that notion of being, you know, at a table with your peers, persuading in your country's interest, a skill, as I say, I think it's a soft diplomatic skill. We weren't, as young diplomats, forced into what is now a more tough environment, I think, for young diplomats on the field, trying to promote trade policy, for example, or be involved in foreign direct investment discussions. So it was, I would regard, a very easy entry. And from my own point of view then, I guess I also did something that wasn't recommended. I still recommend it to young women diplomats, which is I took the risk of leaving the diplomatic service. You are a stellar example of someone who never had to come back. I took the risk of jumping ship. I took the risk of jumping ship. Having tasted that for 8 or 10 years, I felt that there was an opportunity outside the Foreign Service. So I jumped twice. So I jumped initially into the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. And there, I wasn't hidebound by a hierarchy that was in place in Ireland in terms of seniority. And so I did well in the OECD for 10 years and came back into the system again, but then was plucked out then finally for my last exit by Taoiseach Enda Kenny and Tomás Beim Gilmore when they brought me back from Brussels, essentially to head up the economic recovery. So I jumped in and out of it, and I think for younger women it's really important. I would argue was made my career, the idea that I was as good as my last job and that I could build in a modular way. So a soft diplomatic route, multilateralism, and building your career over time in a modular way.
Well, clearly you have extraordinary skills, and that's not something that's easily taught. Do you have any advice for, you know, sometimes they say that people should have a rabbi early on, and if you can stick with that rabbi, it helps your career. Did you have did you feel you had a rabbi or a number of rabbis?
A number, I mean, I didn't have one single one that I could point to. I was lucky, I guess, to have a number. Some of them were political in the sense that I would, in the longer term, always have looked as a guiding light to Mary Robinson's career, and she certainly was an inspirational one. I worked very closely with some outstanding public servants. One who comes to mind always when I say that is Maurice Hayes, who is known in this house. But I would say Maurice, who was the most senior public servant in Northern Ireland of Roman Catholic nationalist background at a very difficult time, came as a wonderful European to assist Ireland in time of need when we were having a sort of repeat offence in losing European referenda. And by chance, I was asked, would I sit with Maurice in the Forum on Europe, which you mentioned in the introduction, the chance of a lifetime. I spent, and it wasn't time again, it's this almost unnatural learning environment that seems to suit me, in that it was in the back of a bus. Maurice didn't drive and I didn't have a car, so we had many bus trips in Ireland together. It was watching him sit patiently listening to several countries who were Eurosceptic, several political groups who were Eurosceptic in Ireland, allowing them to speak themselves out of their position and explaining to me as I went what he was doing. You know, skills, as you said, that you know, they're not academic skills, they're not skills really that can be passed on. You observe them. There are two people I just pick out from that. I didn't have one.
Very good ones. In fact, Maurice won the Brain of Britain when he was young.
Did he?
Very distinctive. George Mitchell strikes me, Senator, as another person who had that capacity to listen. People used to go into him when he was envoy in Northern Ireland from different parties and complain to him for 6 hours about the other side, and he would just nod his head. And then when they'd come out of the room, they'd say, that George Mitchell is a genius. He understands everything. And so there is a bit of that. So just to finish, there are a lot of young people here, and I'm really glad to see so many. When you're young, and maybe when you're female, but also when you're male, how do you deal with, particularly if you're female, with this sort of accidental or the put-down in the old days, the misogynist, who thinks you're there to make the tea? Is there a humorous way you can deal with them? I won't actually touch too much on the Me Too movement, but, you know, again, for young women, they have to navigate waters, and maybe the workplace is a better place these days, but these are issues.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I have to say I have been lucky in my own experience. I've had occasion to say to some other women, that actually never happened to me, but one of the reasons I think that I was lucky is that there is a sense of self that's important in these situations, and a sense that, you know, probably it would have been harder, you know, to try and tell me that I should make the tea, because I didn't come across quite as somebody who was amenable to that kind of a suggestion. I'm not saying that the strongest women can't be challenged in situations, but I think a quiet self-confidence is important, and I would honestly say that I acquired that from an extraordinary mother, Helen, who still is with me. She's somewhere on one of those chairs this evening. But from women educators, from nuns who educated me right throughout my career, as a young student through to going to college, where I never for a moment had a sense that they weren't, you know, absolutely capable and in the right place, and powerful women in our society shaping our young minds. It never struck me that we could be challenged in that. So, you know, I think that being surrounded by strong women, and I think Irish society is good at that. We have... I don't know if we would describe ourselves over time as matriarchal, but we have a deep respect for the feminine, and even if some of our institutions haven't expressed that over time, I think that we have found our way constantly in the UN. These days people remark to me how extraordinary, egalitarian, how progressive Irish society now looks. And you mentioned the marriage bar. You know, when I say in 1973 you had to resign, they find that rather extraordinary that we are suddenly where we are today. I think the fine, strong line of the feminine goes right through that. And I'm lucky to have absorbed some of that in my own.
I saw some evidence of that in your splendid office overlooking the UN and the East River, where you have lots of photographs of yourself with the great and the good, the heads of state around the world. But the one that struck me was a black and white shot of suffragettes marching in Drogheda in 1916. And tell us what the significance of that photograph is for you.
I think you just slight difficulty saying Drogheda again. I look at that every single day. It was an extraordinary moment. I had a mayoral delegation. In my office, they joke, my husband said I'm from the Independent Republic of Drogheda. My office always argued that I'm the ambassador of Drogheda first and the ambassador of Ireland second. But a delegation came from Drogheda, and they were carrying a lot. And I was actually on a busy day, and I thought, goodness, but you know, what's in the bag? And they took out a frame, and it was a frame, a black and white photograph of the main street in Drogheda with white dressed women marching, suffragettes in 1916. And they thought that it would mean something to me. And for me, the idea that deep spirit of female intention was alive on the streets that I grew up in as a child, which was a very small rural town where when you left, your parents put your name inside your coat going to Dublin in case you never came back. This was extraordinary that women in my town were on the barricades speaking for an independence for women that came 40 or 50 years later. And as you say, I'm very lucky to have a splendid office looking at the Parliament of Man, somewhere I never thought growing up in Drogheda I could even imagine being. But those women are there with me, and I think that's the best thing.
So let's turn to the Parliament of Women the United Nations itself. Ireland's President Higgins recently said that the UN brings and can bring out what is best in us. But the question for you is the UN relevant to our lives today? Why do we hear, for instance, so little about the peacekeeping operations? We used to hear a lot about them when there was a conflict. And we've had conflicts in Syria and Africa, but we seem to hear less. What's going on?
I mean, prize to Higgins, I have to say, it was all proud this year. He, for the first time ever, the President delivered our national statement. It's normally done by a member of the government, and he spoke about the UN as a house of hope. And I have to say, of course, I want to believe that that's where it is, because that's what makes me get up and go out every day. I'd have to admit at the moment, it's a house of some disquiet, of an uneasiness. I would say uncertainty. The peacekeepers are there. There's 100,000 men and women wearing blue helmets right now, tonight, in the most dangerous parts of the world. 80 of them died this year. Every single day we hear attacks, they're attacked. But why are we not hearing about them? I think there's a sense in the UN, and the UN is an institution. It doesn't exist without its member states. There's 193 member states there, but there is a sense that there's an unraveling of sorts underway, and it's not limited, I would have to say, to the top table. You know, the top table we think of at the UN as the Security Council, the five permanent members who are there, the victors of the Second World War, anachronistic as that may be, US, UK, Russia, China, France, and that's five. They're at loggerheads, and I mean, that's now a term that people will recognise in that house of hope, that the five powers are at loggerheads in different regions, whether it's Syria or Yemen, and not always on the same issue. The Chinese and the Americans obviously not seeing eye to eye, the British not agreeing with the Russians on several issues. So they're at loggerheads, but it's a bigger fracturing. Some people talk in the UN about center of gravity being lost or fault line. I think it's a genuine fracturing of an old order, and I don't, you know, the institution is doing its best to keep a roof on the house, I would say. But if you look across the way in which the order is breaking up, I think the idea of multilateralism itself, the idea of doing business among several countries around a table with a common shared approach, is contested even now in the UN. I think there is a sort of a rampant unilateralism. We know in our host country, in the United States, that's a popular policy for the current administration, but it's not limited. You know, there are many countries waiting in the wings. There are unknown unknowns. You look at the positioning of the United States as it withdraws, some would use the term retreat, at that top table and in the 193 country rooms, and you look at who occupies that space, and contrary to popular opinion, that actually isn't Russia. It's China is moving in there. So some would say we look at Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General, and I disagree slightly with him on this, says the UN may be seeing now in-house a sort of a duopoly emerge, where you have the US and China at polar ends of two systems with their own economic models, with their own currencies, with their own artificial intelligence, with their own internet, with their own social systems, and that you will find at one end perhaps other countries who are cleaving to a Chinese model, and you have to watch what's happening in the Pacific and in Africa, where countries may feel more comfortable in surrendering certain rights, certain what we would regard as democratic fundamental rights, in exchange for a state-run economy that's producing jobs and lifting people out of poverty. You have to say the Chinese model has done something none of us have ever seen economically, and no one knows where it will end. That's one risk in the UN. I think myself it's going to find itself more multipolar, and therefore our interest will definitely play. I think you're looking at a bigger horizon, the US and China, certainly the European Union, and India, question mark, I would probably say. But I'm not mentioning there, if you think about it, if you think of what the UN feels like, where's Japan? where is the UK, where is Russia, where are the Australians, for example. And they will have to make up their mind. There's a sort of an identity crisis issue for big countries like that, who looked like they were major shapers of a global agenda. So everyone is sort of watching everyone else. The net result in the UN is the peacekeepers are on the field. There's a huge amount of good work being done. Nobody talks about successful elections in the DRC or in Madagascar, countries that, you know, are not on the NPR every morning. People aren't recognizing that there is actually a dialogue going on in Afghanistan. Women aren't being included, another issue, but there's dialogue underway. The South Sudanese have a sort of a political process in place. Even in Syria, constitutional committee now looking. So there is progress. So I'm not saying that this is a dark house. The vulnerable, the marginalised, migration, climate change, we can talk about those. Those issues are being dealt with because, frankly, if I go back to the beginning, this rampant unilateral approach ignores the blindingly obvious that you can't solve the key problems as a single country. Even the United States can't do that.
So migration. Are you optimistic about the Treaty of Paris in, you know, climate change?
Well, you know, there's a huge degree. I said, you know, we're 193 countries. 100 of the countries at the UN are populations of under 10 million. Of those, a third are small island states. So you have over 35, almost 40 countries who have existential reasons to want that Paris Agreement not just respected, but in fact implemented, and we're not on track. The great moment of the Sustainable Development Goals, Paris, the INF Treaty unraveling now, but you know, the Global Compact on Climate and Migration, they were big moments in the last 5 or 10 years, but they're now vulnerable because of that dysfunctionality I spoke earlier. I would say on Paris, it's probably the one that has the most sort of political determination behind it. I'm not revealing anything I haven't said publicly before, that I have great faith in Emmanuel Macron. I think he's a rather extraordinary man, and he has, I think, embraced leadership on the issue, and he's linking gender to it. He's very, very clearly, and Ireland would hugely subscribe to this view, sees Paris as critical to conflict resolution, because a lot of the climate-engendered conflict on the African continent, for example, is now provoking migration and provoking instability. Some could argue, you know, help Mr. Trump be elected. You know, so these are linked. None of these issues are individual issues that can be solved by one country or individually on their own. So there is a sort of a chain, a blockchain dimension to the kind of problems we're dealing with, and therefore the political weight behind it. I think the European Union, in this case, led formally by Angela Merkel, Mother Climate, now by Macron on this, have really captured public imagination.
That's great. So just switching gears slightly, thinking of Ireland, how is Ireland viewed in the UN context? Are there positive or negative assumptions about the Irish that you might like to reflect on?
Because I reflect on this every minute of every day, wearing the T-shirt. Look, I don't think it's chauvinistic if I say that people regard us as the quintessential UN country. We, you know, you mentioned I have a lovely office. I'm lucky as a diplomat to live in a government-owned property. And I think as an example of Ireland seeing the world through UN prism, and we do still see it, the government bought the property I now live in 1956. Which, if you think of what Ireland was like at the time, is a pretty remarkable decision to make to invest in an apartment for a diplomat in New York. But part of the reason was that the foreign minister at the time came and spent 3 months of the year in New York. We today, however many years later, 60-something years later, We have missions in 80 countries around the world. I've mentioned again that 193, so we're now on the ground every day in 113 countries. Back in 1956, I think we had 22 missions abroad. So, in other words, Irish foreign policy was pushed out here through the UN. And to some extent, today we do that. So, first of all, we have always seen the UN as a forum that Ireland could find itself in and express itself in. That big term that we use all the time about multilateralism, it's a respect for rule of law, and it's a kind of a solidarity about how you do your business. For me, that defines both of our drivers at the UN. That respect for international law from the get-go mattered much more to Ireland and matters much more to those 100 countries with populations of 10 million than it does to China or to India or to the US. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we are dependent on occasionally the kindness of strangers, but in fact that translates into a recognisable legal framework where we can have our own rights and our entitlements and the benefits of being a small country on a big stage respected. But with that comes the Irishness of our being able to see that in others. And there's where our sense of empathy, our partnership, which we see as natural because we've known when we didn't have it. We've had our troubled history and we haven't enjoyed partnership over time. Partnership, empathy and independence are our bylines. But I think that that partnership has worked for us in the UN. People still to this day will look for our name on a resolution or will ask me all the time, will we turn up to something, because an Irish presence at an event brings a degree of credibility. I wouldn't exaggerate that, and I know I'm being strange, so other countries of course carry equal credibility, but none of it's as interesting as the Irish
So Ambassador, I've heard you give credit to the overseas service of thousands of Irish priests and nuns for hundreds of years. Maybe it goes back even to how the Irish saved the world in the Dark Ages. But I found this, and I thought I'd give you a copy of it in case you don't have one. It's a book, St. Patrick's Foreign Legions, a souvenir of 1961, by a priest called Martin Bain. And it's got where we have people, missions, in Europe, America, Oceania, Asia, Africa. And they're all here. So I thought I'd give you this and say for Ambassador Geraldine Baron-Mason, leading St. Patrick's Foreign Legions in the 21st century. But I would like to comment on that we're sort of, we have a tradition of service out there already.
Absolutely. Well, this is wonderful. I will treasure this. I may well add it to my voting list and double check if there is some. It's funny, when I was coming on my posting here, you get pre-posting briefings, and someone told me check all the religious orders and their geographical distribution, and this goes to speak to that. It has, you know, puts in a simple way, I like to say to people that, you know, wherever Irish people have gone off the island, we have never done harm to people where we arrived. And that is a remarkable thing, and it's a huge pride that I have in being able to say that, because if you look around the countries, let's say, who sit at that top table in the Security Council, there's no one there can say that. We have no colonial baggage. We have never invaded a country. We have never brought our troops except as peacekeepers. And the first sort of line of Irish people, diplomat politicians really, were nuns, priests, educators and health workers. And because, and President Higgins in the most poetic way speaks about this, you know, deep in our system, you know, in our DNA is a sense of solidarity with the vulnerable and the marginalised. And that has stayed deep in the living memory still of particularly African countries. And I mentioned earlier, it's so common that I meet an ambassador or a minister from Africa, as I did this week, who will say to me, I can recite all of Yeats. Father Maguire taught me in St. Mary's in Nairobi, or, you know, I've been told also by some African politicians they hid under nuns' beds during their revolution, because, of course, our priests and our nuns, like Irish people in general, were highly politically aware and active in their countries of adoption. You know, they helped to birth many countries. When Nelson Mandela came to Ireland, I know that the deep respect he had for the support Ireland gave in his own struggle and his own country's struggle is also respected. I had the South African ambassador in the mission yesterday for lunch telling me about the priest he was educated by Christian Brothers in a shanty town. So these people definitely laid the seeds of that solidarity and support. I think many of them now, generationally, it's a memory rather than an act of service. And the predecessor, a predecessor of mine, Richard Ryan, probably known to many of you here, said when he did the job that I'm now engaged in having trying to have Ireland elected to the Security Council, he said he met many, many of the educators and health workers who were still in the church at the time. 20 years later now, that's harder to do. But I think just to finish up on it, I think our non-governmental organisations, our TROCRA, Concern Workers Goal, Irish Aid, and the extraordinary work they do, Africa, Asia, they are the new generation of the St. Patrick's Legions, even if they don't know it or call themselves that.
Well, you mentioned the bid for the UN Security Council, and Vesper gave me this badge, which she has on as well, which is an Irish shamrock with the dove of UN peace superimposed on it. So we're running for a UN Security Council seat, 21-22, the elections next June. We're for two seats that are available, and we're up against Canada and Norway. So two of the three will win it. So why? Why is Ireland pursuing a seat on the UN Security Council? Is it going to be more trouble than it's worth, given how contentious issues are? And what's in it for Ireland?
Well, it's certainly a lot of trouble, I admit to that straight away. I mean, it's known now as a sort of the most hotly contested election to the Security Council in several generations. So, that's not our fault. Ireland was last on the Security Council 20 years ago. I think our modesty doesn't push us into a situation like some other countries which feel every 5 or 7 years, it's my turn again, and they put their hands up very frequently. We wait our turn, actually, and there's no rotational rhythm, but for a country of our size, we've served two full terms in our history before, one half term by chance, as it were. Why are we running? I think we see ourselves as a smaller member state, and small is not a negative term at the UN. Sometimes it's small almost equates to integrity and often skill and capacity, because we're small, we need to be able to project ourselves well. I think we feel that a country like ours, our voice is needed at the table. That the notion that power and might is right is clearly not working, and that there is, and I don't pretend to say otherwise, there is a degree of dysfunctionality at that top table, and that the elected members, there are 10 elected members, of whom a certain number, when I say we're modest, you know, bigger countries like Japan, Brazil, India, run very often. So let's say you take the three of them out of the reckoning, you're really looking at 7 countries coming up every 2 years for a chance to sit there. And we think it's an opportunity for responsibility. There used to be a consideration in terms of electing countries that you would look at how a country in its own way, in a practical way, supports international peace and security. And that used to translate to examining peacekeeping support. We're second to none, really, not in hard numbers. You can look over time at the hard numbers. We're the only country in the UN which has had an unbroken record of peacekeeping service. We have never, for a single day since 1958, not had Irish peacekeepers on the ground in fragile areas across the world. And on any one day now, we have about 1,000 men and women engaged in our peacekeeping operation, 700-800 in the field, turning around with 200-300 getting ready to go out. So we have demonstrated our own, modest as we may be, contribution to peacekeeping.
That's very impressive.
I think people also, if I may just say that, I think people see Ireland and the way in which we have managed to emerge. Somebody said you speak more about yourself now, earlier, as an island, George, said you speak more about yourself as an island, and we do. I think that we think of ourselves as a global island now, in that we have learned how to build bridges. We have found ourselves a place at a very big, difficult table in Brussels, and suddenly found out, you know what, we know how to do this.
Yeah.
We have been adopted, I think, as mediators. We have shown our capacity, as I say, to change our own society. So what I'm describing is a lived experience of conflict resolution on our own island.
Yeah.
And Mary McAleese, I think, was the one who said that we are a first world country with a raw third world memory.
Yeah.
And a developing country memory. We don't use first and third worlds anymore, but that was a quote from her at a time. And that has huge resonance in the UN, because at the end of the day, I sat with an ambassador of an African country today, tying my wares, asking, you know, what their view would be of Ireland. And she said to me, the way we look at you is, how would you look and sit on that council? And would you look and think like a country from Africa? And as we look at you, your premium that you put on respecting, as there are 270 migrants across the globe, what you do in your development policy, the fact that it's not a trade aid policy, the idea that you put your own people in harm's way. Anybody want to guess how many peacekeepers there are from Russia or the United States out there now?
Yeah.
I can tell you, there are 90 each. Each of those two countries have 90.
Wow.
You know, Ireland actually puts its people as well as its money where its mouth is. So I think that is respected in the UN system. And I also would argue, surprisingly, that our EU membership is a huge advantage to Ireland in this campaign, and seen as something people are concerned about losing at the top table. By the time we get to the end of 2021, there will be one EU country on the Security Council.
Wow.
And that will be France. So that wow that came from Miriam is something I get every day. People say, well, wait a minute. I mean, where will the...
Yeah.
And you look around, and they're not there.
Yeah.
The British will no longer, unfortunately, regrettably, be at the EU table in, you know, very likely.
And France would be representing itself, right?
Voila. So a lot of countries say, well, you can't leave the French there on their own. So we of course, you know, the French don't want to be there on their own. The French recognise their role as a much more representative role. So, you know, they're bringing the EU, the weight of the EU. The EU is the biggest development investor, or the development support in the world. We're the biggest investor in the developing world. We're the country with probably the strongest human rights, or the group of countries, strongest human rights record. We have the biggest humanitarian budget. So a lot of countries in Asia and Africa say, well, hold on a minute, we want to see an EU voice there. We would bring that with us.
That's fascinating. I hadn't really thought of the EU voice, but that's really interesting. Clearly, with the famine and colonization and migration, we have, as you say, a good experience in that area. So that leads me on to gender then, and your role on the UN Commission on Women. And would you, how would you feel about the argument that women leaders play a greater role than men when it comes to conflict resolution, or that we need more women at the table?
Well, I'd agree with your second comment that we need more at the table. The first, unfortunately, isn't true in pure empirical terms, in that we don't have enough women. At the moment, the statistics all show, it's a bit like the economic argument about women on the board of a company, statistics all show that peace negotiated with women being involved, so women negotiated peace agreements, are more durable than anything. They're sustainable. Mary Robinson has argued this for a very long time and has done a huge amount of work on the ground, grassroots women in Africa. The Irish Good Friday Agreement is a prime example of engaging women in the negotiation process, or women pushing their way in. They weren't so much invited as arrived. We frequently have Monica McWilliams, Brona Hines in the UN talking to Yemeni women, talking to Syrians, because we know that without them at the table, the peace won't be a durable one. And we also know that from a very practical point of view, that women's engagement ensures that issues that are often left out of peace agreements, like reconciliation, like victimhood, like education across segregation lines, whether it's religious or national identity lines, those are the kind of issues. What I spoke about earlier in my education about the soft power part of a female head, those issues tend to be introduced by women in peace agreements and just simply don't make it to the table. Unfortunately, in the last 2 years, I think of all peace agreements negotiated, only 4% of them included women in them, so it's shockingly low. The most translated resolution of the UN ever over time is a resolution called 1325. I see Katerina from the Irish Mission smiling. She has this on her brain because that's a resolution that's Women, Peace and Security Resolution. It's the debate that's most oversubscribed at the Security Council. But where do you move from the rhetoric to the reality? You have the massive gaps. You have governments with action plans to include women. You have investment in training women. But actually, when it comes to the hardcore negotiations, women are not getting to the table. And the Afghan situation is a glaring example of that, where, you know, we know what happened with the Taliban. And Afghan women, for the first time, they've nominated the Afghan government as a young female representative at the UN, a brilliant young woman. Her big concern is the women were not at the table in the last round of negotiations. So, you know, if you want sustainable peace and development, you simply cannot ignore 50% of the global population.
That's a very good point.